Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is writer and historian Roger Luckert. He is the Jeffrey Tillotson Professor on 19th Century Studies at Birkbeck College, University of London. And tonight, we're talking about his book, Gothic, An Illustrated History. Roger, welcome back to the show. It is a real pleasure to talk about this book.
Oh, delighted to come back. Always happy to talk about the Gothic.
I guess that is so. This is so far you're two for two for me. I mean, both of these books. First of all, it's a great introduction to a concept of and interesting about the Gothic, but also it's wonderfully illustrated too. And there's a lot of film stills that you use, which I think is just brilliant. Is it easy? You write in the beginning, and I found this so true. It used to be easy to define Gothic, but it isn't anymore.
Yeah, I think I do think that's right. It used to be a very, very specific and probably quite a shameful, actually, area of culture. You know, it's very low culture. If you think about horror films, they're the kind of lowest of the low, really, and quite often considered to be trash culture. And that's only really changed in the last maybe 30, 40 years. Certainly post-war, I think, we've got a really different sense of kind of cultural cachet of this. And it just seems to be that it's a cliche that you say that the Gothic speaks to the anxiety of its times.
Right.
And maybe we live in very anxious times. But it does seem to be absolutely everywhere, so it kind of overflows, and it seems to come up in lots of different places and lots of different cultures too. So I think global TV and global media has had a lot to do with transporting this. So you find weird reflections of it coming back at you from Japan, or you know, from Indonesia, from South Africa, from South America, everywhere. You know, it's kind of all over the world now, and that I think is a very recent phenomenon.
Yeah, it's interesting because when you originally, decades ago, if you were to think about Gothic, you would think about, and you describe this perfectly, it's like a product of the northern European climes and
right.
The Alpine mountains in storm, a castle with a laboratory maybe, you know.
Yeah.
And that has become so much more different. Like I really think about Japanese horror films and Korean horror films being particularly Gothic now. And
yeah, I mean, my kind of theory, I think, is that wherever the power is located, whether that's economic or political or social power, you kind of have an underside, which is the Gothic, that's kind of talking about all of the bad things that come with that power. So it starts in England in the 1760s at the height, or the beginning, really, of that global power of the British Empire. In the 20th century, it's definitely shifting towards America. But then you start to think, well, where are the places now that are experiencing the cutting edge of hyper-capitalism, if you like? And that's definitely Korea. And I think Korea has special reasons for being anxious with this divided peninsula. But also, you know, Japan, where they've had this high point of economic power, and also seeing it perhaps wane or become stagnant. And so there's lots and lots of kind of anxiety about that. So I think that's a way of tracking it across the world. Certainly, that's how I think of it.
And I want to mention the structure of the book to the audience. You basically investigate what you call 20 traveling tropes, four sections of five essays each. And we're only going to talk about some stuff in the beginning because otherwise, as much as I'd want to talk about the rest of the book, I want to keep it down. We're going to talk about architecture and form and then go into some of the architectural forms that are identified as Gothic. The pointed arch. Okay.
Yeah.
Sell me that as that's like one of those things. I wasn't prepared for the pointed arch as being a topic of the Gothic, but talk to me about it.
Okay. Yeah. So this is really crucial for understanding, I guess, Gothic architecture. So if you come to London, what's really odd about it is that it's a Victorian city, but it's full of fake, or in some cases real, but mostly fake, Gothic architecture, so medieval architecture. And so you think of our classically our Houses of Parliament. Well, you know, they burned down in the 1830s, and people thought for a while, maybe we shouldn't build it again. But they did decide that they would have our Houses of Parliament. And of course, it was going to be in the Gothic Revival style. Now, that is not obvious at all, but actually in the late 18th century, so 1790s, if you think about England being kind of quivering in fear on the edge of Europe, mm-hmm. because Europe and particularly France is having a big revolution, and they're full of anxiety about whether that revolution is going to come across the Channel. It's only 30 miles away, so maybe it's going to arrive. Lots of paranoia, lots of fear. Actually, what you got was a sense of we need to really commit to an idea of tradition and history, and we're going to decide that the Gothic form, these amazing cathedrals with their towering pinnacles and spires and their very striking pointed arches in the windows and in the doorways, that is going to represent English tradition and democracy, and it's rooted in Saxon history, where they used to meet in these democratic forums and decide how they were going to do their politics. And all of that, it was all going to be rooted in that. So that's why there's so much Gothic Revival architecture in England in the 19th century. What's hilarious, of course, is that it's not at all English. And, you know, the first Gothic cathedral was in France. Just don't tell any English person from the 1780s that. And even worse, it actually comes from the Middle East. And it's actually, an Eastern, even Islamic kind of pattern of how you build the pointed arch. So it's this particular architectural innovation that came back the other way from the Crusades, in fact. So I love this because it's like a sense of English history thinking that it's found its root, its identity, and actually, like always, that identity is really complicated and mixed and hybrid.
But that brings us eventually into what I really want to talk about tonight is ruins. And when I think of the Gothic, the ruins chapter really hits home. That idea that you had these huge edifices that once were of powerful people, but now are in this big scramble of stones, and then especially the ruins at night. And your book never just stays with that. You always digress into some fascinating stories. For instance, there was a craze for artificial ruins in the mid-1700s. Yeah. Talk to me about that. That just made me laugh out loud.
Right. Yeah, this is really funny, isn't it? So, it's very, very odd. So, again, this is all about how do we try and communicate that we've been here for hundreds of years, that we're completely stable, that, this country house that I happen to own is not a recent acquisition but has been here for centuries. Well, what you do is you usually kind of point at ruins and just think, well, they must be old, they must be ancient. And in the 18th century, the Grand Tour was this thing where very wealthy people from England would travel around Europe and they would go and contemplate ruins. You know, so you would go to Rome and look at the ruins, go to Athens. If you had more money, you would go to Egypt and look at these kind of amazing ruins of a civilization that clearly had passed. And that was all brought home. So that actually quite a lot of these country houses, which were beginning to get extremely wealthy from global trade, they wanted to kind of communicate that they had long tradition. So quite often some people would build either follies, you know, crazy kind of architecture, but also ruins, like completely fake ruins. And sometimes there are places where they actually had ruins, but they weren't quite pretty enough. So they knocked the ruins down to build new ruins that were much more kind of aesthetically pleasing. And that sort of idea feels very strange and alien, but this is a very common kind of thing that people did. And, you know, it's so resonant as an image, because sometimes the ruin might represent triumph over your enemies. So, you know, again, England is full of monasteries that were stripped of all of their value by Henry VIII when he broke with Rome and formed the Protestant kind of church, the Church of England. And he sent the monasteries into ruin. And keeping those ruins allows you, reminds you, we Protestants have won. We've been victorious over Europe, you know. So they have these lots of kind of resonant meanings, both tradition but also triumph, and also, you know, all of these resonances.
Is there an aspect of memento mori about this Gothic passion for ruins too, that, you know, this everything is eventually going to pass?
Yeah, definitely there is that. I think this idea of there was a famous Latin tag which is translated as so pass all the glories of the world. You know, that sense of you contemplate ruins.
Sic transit gloria mundi?
Death.
Was that
say again, sorry?
Sic transit gloria mundi?
Sic transit gloria mundi, that's right. So, you know, so pass the glories of the world. So that idea that you contemplate these in a kind of pious way, you know, you're thinking about mortality and humility, but actually it's also a sign of, you know, wealth and triumph that you can travel to ruins and see them and contemplate them. It's also a slight indication that you have lived and these have passed away, that your enemies are sent into ruin and so on. So, you know, it's definitely a place to contemplate this. It's why I think that everyone enjoys disaster movies, because we like blowing stuff up. We like seeing, you know, these empires pass. There's a reason why, you know, American audiences cheered Independence Day, that alien invasion film, when the aliens targeted the White House. You know, that kind of sense of hooray, yes, yes, we can shift this, you know, structure and this politics. We can go somewhere else. We can send it into ruin and think about a new possibility beyond. So it's got lots of conflicting emotions.
One of the things I always enjoy about your books is you also have some spectacularly bizarre examples. And I'm thinking of the Gothic temple in the garden at Stowe, designed by James Gibbs for Sir Richard Temple. Can you just talk about that?
Yeah, this is one of the most famous of these kind of fake ruins, and it is it's a very striking image. I guess you know, listeners could look it up, but this is the Gothic temple, it's called, and it's just like a frontis of what looks like a cathedral with two towers on each side, and, you know, very elegant arched doorways and arched windows, but it's basically no thicker than a door, really. You know, it's just a kind of flat thing that you can come across in a landscape. It was all designed to be seen in a setting, a very picturesque setting, to make it as aesthetically pleasing as possible. All 18th century people wanted to experience not just the beautiful, but also the sublime. You know, would pass beyond. You know. So lots of Gothic novels in the 18th century bang on endlessly about landscape that is sublime. You know, so they're like mountains. So the reason why Frankenstein's monster keeps disappearing up mountains is because it's associated with the sublime. So this temple sits in this landscape, which is supposed to be very, very evocative. And again, you know, it's very similar to the painting, say, of Caspar David Friedrich, who was obsessed with painting ruins and these images of kind of ruined cathedrals in winter landscapes. They're kind of classic sublime spaces.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is writer and historian Roger Luckhurst. He is the Geoffrey Tilston Professor on 19th Century Studies at Birkbeck College, University of London. Tonight, we're talking about his book, Gothic, an Illustrated History. Now, the idea of ruins gets even more gothicized, if that's even a word. People started writing stories about nighttime walks among the ruins. And there's a quote in your book, "Night heightens the awfulness of the place." And so much poetry was written about stuff like that. There was, William Wadsworth, Lines Composed a Few Miles Above Tintern Abbey in 1798. The night really sort of, and then I'm sure there was a tawny owl calling in the background or something like that. But it's amazing. They really sort of heighten that up, and that becomes such a trope that right down into the 20th century, when you think about, you mentioned the film, the original Frankenstein, that is exactly what is Gothic about that film, is that against the lightning in the sky at night, that ruins of that castle.
Yeah, that's right. And it's, you know, again, you can think of lots of examples of this. And obviously, in a way, the nighttime is the opposite of rational daytime and light and enlightenment. So, you know, to set something at night is when reason is kind of done, when we're falling asleep, when we're having nightmares and dreams. But also, you know, we have our superstitious fears about the night and nighttime, those kind of childhood fears of the dark. But all of that is kind of bubbling away here. And then again, it's linked to the sublime, so that one of the big philosophers of the sublime, Edmund Burke, talked about what makes us truly terrified. And it's something of gigantic size, but also something we can't quite grasp. It's too big, or we can't quite see it. It's obscured either by mist or by darkness. And so that's a sense of not quite understanding scale or where you are. You're like being in a dream, you know, where you can't quite work out the shape of the room that you're in, or it keeps changing or altering. You know, that's all absolute grist in the mill of the Gothic, which is thinking about the irrational and the dreamlike. It's why, you know, quite a lot of horror films make absolutely no sense logically. in a way, you know, that's part of the point, is that they're this dreamlike nightmare structure that the minute you think about it as a rational viewer, it doesn't make any sense and becomes ridiculous. But actually, if you go with it, you're in this completely obscure, weird, terrifying space. And that's what the Gothic is trying to evoke.
And then it brings it down. In your next chapter, you talk about the fragment.
Yeah.
And I found this chapter very evocative. Let's start with the siblings, John and Anna Akins, who wrote, I love the fact that you got access to all these weird, obscure, on the pleasure derived from objects of terror.
Yeah.
And they're looking, again, they're looking for the sublime, the mix of terror with pleasure. But why a fragment? It's a fragment of an old building, right? Or a fragment, or even a written fragment.
Yes, that's right. And again, you know, they created fake fragments as well. So quite often the early Gothic novels, so the first ever Gothic novel was by Horace Walpole, and it was called A Castle of Otranto. When it was first published, because there's no precedent for this, when it was first published, it had a preface that said, look, I'm really sorry this is so bad and basic, but actually it's a medieval manuscript, and it's obviously it's Italian, so they're not very rational people. See what you think. It might be interesting. And as soon as it became a huge success, the second edition just said, yep, that's by me. I'm Horace Walpole, actually, and that preface was a fake. And this is quite a common device in Gothic, is that you get this sort of fake preface saying it's a medieval manuscript, or it's Spanish, or it's Italian. As long as it's not English, as long as it's not British, that's fine, because you can kind of let all of its weirdness be kept in, you know, for the reader. And so this idea of on the pleasure derived from objects of terror was accompanied by, they had an example of a fragment of a story. And that's just a very short beginning to, there's a classic medieval knight wandering around in a forest, and gets lost, night falls, he heads towards a strange kind of castle structure that he finds there, introduced to a slightly odd, unnerving person who's probably dead, but we don't know yet. And it just simply breaks off because it doesn't really need to go any further. It's just a fragmentary start. We can probably all still the horror film that will follow in. We kind of don't need anything other than the fragment. So what they suggest is that actually this sense of just suggestion of breaking off, of not showing the monster or the gothic horror is one way of being really effective in your aim to try and terrify your reader, is that you leave it to their imagination. This is what ruins do or fragments do, is that you have to complete it as a reader or a viewer. You have to sort of fill it in as an active person engaged with this piece of art. So that idea that a fragment is going to provoke you and your imagination into producing the terror is really key to the gothic.
I want to talk about gothic homes. We're going to run out of time. But I have to talk about, you know, obviously there's the castle, the big dark castle, but there's also Fonthill Abbey, the grand folly of William Beckford. Beckford is the author of Vathek.
That's right, yeah.
So this became a tourist attraction.
Oh, yeah. Well, Horace Walpole, who I mentioned, who wrote The Castle of Otranto, he also had a house that he threw together out of, you know, mock medieval bits and pieces.
Fragments.
That was the first kind of Gothic house, and it became a tourist attraction just outside London, and it's still there. And it's still really worth visiting. It's called Strawberry Hill. It's a very famous mad Gothic kind of concoction. And he wrote his Gothic story inside that structure, so that's really important. There is another great Gothic writer and architect, William Beckford, whose house sadly doesn't survive because Beckford was one of the wealthiest men in Britain in the 1700s. His family had huge plantations in the Caribbean, so vast amounts of money pouring in from sugar. And he decided he was going to build this gigantic mock medieval kind of cathedral, but it was really a place to live in. And because he lived above the plains that looked down on Salisbury, he was determined to build a spire that was even bigger than Salisbury Cathedral, which famously, you know, has this tower that you can see from 20 or 30 miles away. So he built this gigantic tower, spent vast amounts of money on that, most of his fortune, and at the first storm, it fell down because the architect he'd hired wasn't really an architect. He could do the style, but he couldn't really do the engineering or the substance. Great. So they forgot to build any foundation. So it just kind of fell over. And it became, actually, he was quite pleased, I think. He became a ruin, of course, which is fantastic. but actually, in the end, he had to sell all of his amazing book collection and his medieval collections in order to pay off his debtors. It's a wonderful story of a kind of Gothic folly that becomes a ruin and then in itself disappears. There's very little trace of Fonthill Abbey left now.
There's a great quote. I think it's by him, quoted in your book. "Some drink to forget their unhappiness. I build."
Yeah, it's absolutely perfect, isn't it? And Beckford, God. I mean, it's worth saying, I guess, that Beckford wrote Vathek, and this is a kind of really transgressive Gothic story that came out in the 1780s and was considered to be pretty scandalous. It was about a kind of caliph in the exotic East. It's all completely invented, but, you know, set in this kind of fictional Oriental East, and he gets dragged off to hell for his horrible transgressions, and he's clearly having a great time. Beckford himself was chased out of England for his sexual dalliances and transgressions, and had to live abroad for a few years. So you know, all of this imagination in architecture and in fiction and in people's lives like Beckford, they all kind of merge together, and you get lots and lots of people like that in the history of the Gothic. You think of someone like Oscar Wilde, who wrote a great Gothic novel, but also lived in a sense a life that was ruined, literally ruined by his transgressions. So this is an art form that kind of attracts weird, transgressive people.
We're almost out of time, but there's a section in this book, in this section, and you have a photograph, and you also have a couple of photographs of a painting, Edward Hopper's House by the Railroad, which is, when you look at it, is a classic American Gothic. I didn't realize how much that the house from Psycho was taken from that. It really, the design of the house from Psycho is literally a copy of Edward Hopper's painting.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's clear from Hitchcock's source. I mean, this is, you know, a version of the Carpenter Gothic, which is very native to America. But yes, so Hitchcock, as an outsider, I guess, was kind of really struck by the oddity and the atmosphere in that Hopper painting. I love that detail that I'm sure your listeners know, that the Psycho House, which sits on the hill above the motel where all of the dastardly deeds happen, Hitchcock built it at three-quarter size,
yep,
so that it looked kind of further away. But that's the sense of a house shifting size and shape and becoming a kind of dreamlike, weird structure that you can't quite navigate or understand. There's definitely something wrong about the perspective on that house. And you know that if you've seen the film, terrible things are happening in that house. And it's also perfect for a kind of drawing out from Hopper's painting of that sort of eerie atmosphere that he's so good at producing in his paintings.
We were talking just before we started about the house in The Haunting, the film The Haunting, of Shirley Jackson's The Haunting of Hill House. And that's like a house that you can't figure out. In other words, it's just got rooms leading into rooms leading into rooms and all sorts of strange. So the actual architecture, that sense of evil architecture, is very much Gothic in that. We are.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. And, you know, we have, that's the classic location, isn't it, for Gothic these days. Less now cathedrals or castles, and much more about, either private homes where terrible things have happened, or, you know, public spaces like hotels. I mean, one of my key reference points is The Shining, Stephen King.
Oh, yeah.
And that hotel that kind of accrues all of this terrible history and is haunted by all of these different acts of violence. But also, you know, if anyone's seen the Kubrick film of that, there's something very unnerving about how that is shot, and that's because the house makes no sense. It seems to be tracking through corridors that sort of make no sense, and in fact they are just studio constructions.
We're going to have to stop there, Roger, because we're completely out of time.
Sure.
We could go on, as I warned you, forever about this book. My returning guest tonight is writer and historian Roger Luckhurst. He is the Jeffrey Tillotson Professor on 19th Century Studies at Birkbeck College, University of London. We've been talking about his book, and trust me, we've only scratched the surface of the very beginning of it. Gothic, an Illustrated History. Roger, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much. Great question. Thank you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.